From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the challenges of attracting young people to making a life on the farm.
I feel like it might be hard to ask a young person like myself who had a 9-to-5, who had a 401k, benefits, weekends off, to exchange that for a life of farming.
Then gardening expert Melinda Myers talks about the benefits of gardening for your health.
A lot of gardeners for years know that when they go and pull weeds or plant flowers, myself included, we feel better. It improves our mood. We get rid of some stress. Well, research is now proving that to be true.
SAS Mel Muskimmon tries to move her father into assisted living, and we learn about the play Raghead, which explores what it means to be an American in the wake of the Sikh temple shooting here 7 years ago. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Farming contributor Dave Kozlowski owns and operates Pine Hole Gardens in Oak Creek with his wife, Sandy Rodenz. They gave up other careers more than a decade ago in order to pursue the demanding and rewarding profession of farming. Kozlowski says it was a steep learning curve, but their fellow farmers were a big help as they got started. Now the mentee becomes the mentor. Back in March, Kozlowski brought along Sarah Crone of Village Farmstead, which is also in Oak Creek. Crone gave up her previous career a little over a year ago to farm full-time. Although she and her partner Sam Oden had almost 10 years of community gardening and hobby farming behind them. Oden's sister joins their team this year as well as they grow organic produce for direct sales to consumers. Crone and Kozlowski joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio in March to discuss their different perspectives on farming, its challenges, and its rewards. Crone started by explaining how she knew she had to become a farmer.
I didn't know anything about farming or business, but I kind of had this moment when I was in college and I didn't really know what I wanted to study, and I kind of had some resistance to joining the workforce and doing a 9-to-5, which I couldn't find anything that I wanted to do. And I studied environmental ethics, and I thought about all these scholars and authors that I was reading about and farmers, and I just thought that this was such a wholesome way to spend my life, just like growing things that we directly need every single day. And so we decided after some years of practice that we would take the plunge and go for it. But we didn't know anything about business, and we're learning that it's definitely a business if we're trying to make a livelihood out of it. But we just learned through experience and from mentors such as Dave and Sandy and other farmers that have welcomed us into the community.
Now, for both of you, you know, what was that learning curve like? And is there still one for you, Dave?
Thankfully, there is still one. I mean, when the job becomes boring and you're not learning something, I don't want to do it anymore. So, yeah, every year is a challenge. Every year we learn something. And, you know, I want to say I met Sam, Sarah's partner, before I met Sarah. I was so impressed with his questions and his interest in the business and farming that I was just thrilled that we had young farmers like this coming into the profession. But yeah, I'm still learning. And I would say our stories are fairly similar. I wanted to make the world a little better place, and we just jumped in with both feet into farming. And at that time, there were a number of small farms doing the same thing in the area. And we took advantage of their generosity and time by stopping and visiting them and learning what they were doing. It's pretty much similar to what Sam and Sarah do. So to me, that's the best way to figure things out. Books help, but really it's just talking to another farmer. And that's what we did. And still do, by the way. We still stop at farms.
For you, Sarah, were you surprised at maybe the number of farms that were available for you and your partner, Sam, to go and learn from, like Dave and Sandy? Because, I mean, do we know the number comparative difference between how many farmers you could go and talk to versus you going into farming now in 2018, 19?
Yeah, I mean, we've lost some, but it probably doubled or tripled in that time. Mm-hmm. We had to drive out west of Madison to find a few farms to talk to.
When we first started, the first thing that we decided to do was let's talk to farmers in the area. Let's find farms that are doing things similar to what we aspire to do. and let's call them on the phone and see if they'll just talk to us. And we did. That's how we met Dave and Sandy. We called them on the phone and said, hey, we're thinking about starting a farm. Can we pick your brain? Do you have any wisdom to offer us? And every single farm that we called was more than willing to have a conversation with us, to invite us over. We've just been so welcomed into the farming community that it's a place that I want to stay. And I definitely hope that more people feel welcomed into it as well.
How do you think you can foster more growth? You know, people of the younger generation, as you mentioned, most go into the 9-to-5 job fields or, you know, the more conventional degrees to study, and they're not thinking per se about working the land. And a lot have lost that family connection to farms. You know, no one has a family farm owned by their grandparents or great grandparents or have that connection to the land.
Yeah, I think we're in an interesting spot right now. I think a lot of young people are really interested in farming, and they are interested in changing the way that we eat, and they're changing the way that their lifestyles are. I feel like it might be hard to ask a young person like myself who had a 9-to-5, who had a 401k, benefits, weekends off, to exchange that for a life of farming. But I think a lot more people are interested in it, and we try to encourage our friends who want to come over to be put to work. Like, let's do some farming together. And at the end of the day, it's always so rewarding. They feel rewarded. They feel like they made a difference. They feel like the farm is partly theirs too. And I just think that it's just a good community for people our age to start getting involved in. And I think they're interested in doing it too.
Yeah, I think there's two tracks we have to sort of keep abreast of here. One is, like Sarah and ourselves and so many young farmers, you have to have the mindset and the philosophy to want to do this. And it doesn't matter whether you're growing organic produce or you want to do dairy cows or corn and soybean. I mean, farming is farming. And so you're going to want to do that kind of work. The other track, particularly as it pertains to us, is for those people who are sitting on the fence, we've got to convince them that you can actually make a living doing this. And there's not much ways we can cut our cost. So we have to hope that the public is interested in buying what we produce.
Right. We do need the people that support organic farming as well. Like, not everyone has to be a farmer, but we have to have the people that understand it and they're willing to maybe spend a little bit more money than they're going to spend at Costco buying something that's organic but doesn't have a face or a name that comes along with it.
Now, you mentioned, Sarah, you know, trading the salaries, you may get benefits, weekends off, vacations. You know, you guys are working probably more than you ever have. How has your relationship with money and risk changed as you've changed to the life of a farmer? How do you see things differently?
Well, risk is, it's always a thing that's in our minds. I happen to be a very frugal person in the first place, which made transitioning to farming relatively easy at this point. We're still very new to it, so I can't really speak for what this means financially for us. But I think that the risk of not having benefits or dental insurance, like, those things are okay for me to exchange for different things that I value, such as being my own boss, working with the sunlight hours, moving my body like it was intended to be moved, and just kind of going with those natural rhythms of the universe instead of these values that society holds up, like weekends and paid vacation. Like, those things are a valid exchange for me.
Farmers, I tend to find, are some of the smartest people I know. And along with that is being able to accommodate these kinds of risks and challenges and meet them head on and find solutions to them rather than crumble under the weight of them. And that seems to be a main tenet of pretty much any farmer if they're going to stay in the business. Managing money, what's money? we don't worry about that part, but the risk is a significant challenge, and you have to be willing to meet that challenge.
Dave, you mentioned that farmers are good problem solvers. I'm curious, what have you both found to be the hardest part about farming, whether there's one particular story, an instance of just a crop that gave you all the difficulties, or just the things that you've learned throughout to adjust to?
That's a tough one. There's a lot of things that are hard about farming, but at this point in the game for me, something that I have noticed is the hardest thing is meeting customer expectations. We live in a world of convenience and busyness, and people have lost their connection with food and they've lost their consciousness about food. And I'm finding that it's hard to take your whole life and turn it upside down to grow this produce so that someone can have a beet at the end of the day. But then a lot of people don't even know what to do with a beet at the end of the day. And we're up against these like food subscriptions where food comes to your door with a recipe and the spices, and sometimes it's pre-cut. And it's like, we've already grown all this food. Like, we can't possibly compete with someone who's doing that. Like, if the customers could meet us halfway, frankly, I feel like it would be nice. Like, we all have to make moves here to change the food system. And I feel like small farmers are doing so much already. And, you know, it has to be a group consciousness thing. And if it's not, I don't know that we're going to be able to compete with all the other food options that are out there.
You kind of want to expect a farmer to say, what's the hardest part of your job? Well, you know, it's 13-hour days or 14-hour days. It's not really. It's not a physical thing. I think it's an emotional thing. Like Sarah says, it's hard to go to a farmer's market and have people not buy your produce, have walked right by you. Even some say some nasty things about this stuff. That's emotionally hard because you have a lot of sweat and blood involved in that, in your product. And it's also emotionally difficult to deal with issues like we had last year when you lose an entire carrot crop. It isn't the money. It wasn't the work you put into it. It's just, gosh, you know, how do you bounce back from that kind of loss? So it's an emotional thing, I think.
And, you know, we're talking about the difficult times, but there's also some great successes that you can have throughout farming. And, you know, Dave, you've been in the business for a while, and Sarah, you're pretty new, but do you guys remember your first farm memory where it's like, this is the first plant that I grew successfully, or, you know, what that crop was, or working the land, prepping it for something, and you look and you see and you realize and confirm to yourself, like, yes, this is what I need to be doing.
That happens every spring. It's like happens again and again and again and again. It's always new. When I go out and I scan the field and I can see all the plants coming up and they're all healthy and the weeds have been under control, I get the same thrill I did the first time we did it, when we had one CSA member and we were selling things off the farm, to now with 100 and whatever, 50 or 80 CSA members and selling off the farm. I get the same exact thrill as though it was the first time when I see the plants all in a row, the weeds kept under control, everything looking healthy. Yeah, it just keeps coming back.
My first real experience with that was actually this year. We're doing our first CSA. And when we got our first check in the mail, I almost was brought to tears just thinking, like, these people trust us enough to write us a check for almost $600, and they just trust that we're going to feed them. And it was just, like, so emotional for me just thinking that we have community out there that's willing to trust farmers even though there is a risk. And that's why I'm doing it.
When it comes to the future of farming, how do we get more people like Sarah to consider working a field versus working at a desk?
That's the $10,000 question, isn't it? Yeah. You know, I think, as we sort of mentioned before, partly you have to have the mindset. And sometimes it's not when you're 20 years old. Sometimes it's when you're, you know, in 30s or 40s. But so you have to have the mindset. And secondly, we have to show them that this is a profitable, interesting, challenging business to get into, that it's not just purely grunt work. You know, like I said before, I think farmers are some of the smartest people I know. They know how to fix things. They know how to plant things. They know how to sell things. They can manage money. They're an incredible group of people. So we need to continue to be successful. And then that success, I hope, breeds success.
Yeah, and another thing I think that might get in the way of young people farming is just access to land, and having land be so expensive, and so many of us are still paying off student loans. Yeah. And in our case, we live on a homestead, 14 acres, and not everyone who lives at the homestead is involved in the market farm. But we could never afford to live where we live if we didn't live with a group of people that was helping to pay for the property taxes and just all the costs that come in with living in that space.
That's the other thing that changed in the last 25 years. There was really no money available for us to start a farm back then. But now the USDA does offer new farmer grants and loans. And it sounds like I don't know the details of it, but show them a good business plan, show them that you have some experience, that you did some interning and things like that. And there's the potential for some grants and loans to start your business and expand your business. So that's a good thing. And I think more young people know about that might help, but land's a big issue.
Now, Dave, as we're sitting here with Sarah, I'm sure you're reminded of those first, you know, few seasons where you and Sandy were getting things started. Do you, either of you have questions for each other, you know, while we're here?
I remember our first farmer's market, which was last June, and we're coming from a conventional field, and so we have a lot to make up for in fertility. And I just remember looking at our first market stand and being like, I wonder what Dave's market stand looked like for the first time. Like, I hope his vegetables looked worse than they look now, because there's hope for us that we'll
get
better. But yeah, it's just like, how have you seen difference in when you first started farming and first started working the land? And have you seen your soil grow? And have you seen the biodiversity change on your land?
Yeah, the first stuff was actually pretty good. We were on old pasture, not conventionally farmed land. So it had been in pasture for years and years and years. We had weed problem and grass problem, but the fertility was really good. It was the in-between years when we started to move on, where it took us a while to get the fertility up in the soil. And we're still working on that. As you know, we have very clay soils around here, and they take a good deal of organic matter and to keep them going. But I thought your stuff looked great.
The stuff we brought.
But that's always the case. You know, that's always the case. You're always going to get fork carrots that you're not going to bring to the market. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know. That's what kimchi is all about, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, you're always going to get product like that. And you always want to bring your best product to the market. So don't let those other farmers there fool you, too, because they got a lot of fork carrots and a lot of, you know, blemished radishes and whatnot.
Dave, anything for Sarah?
Yeah, I'm curious about the business plan and how you guys want to grow the business and how you plan on growing the business, because the way we did it seemed really backwards back in the bad old days when the hippies and hippie wannabes started this business and got into it. We just planted and sold. We didn't really think about what the future would be.
We definitely have a business plan, but it's more so we have set financial goals for ourselves. And Sam is totally the mastermind behind all the planning, all the finances. I try to be involved in that as less as I can. But we have basically started with how much money do we hope to make so that we can pay for a year of life? And so we start there, and then we go, how much money do we need to make each week in order for that yearly salary to come to fruition? And then from there, we say, okay, how much do we need to sell of these things to make this much money? And that's where we plan our crops from. So it's kind of starting at a totally made-up point and then working from there to figure out what our year is going to look like.
Did you overestimate last year or underestimate?
We didn't meet our goal, but we had a high goal.
Do you have any words of advice for Sarah going forth? And then, Sarah, do you have any advice or words of encouragement for people who are perhaps on the fence about getting into farming themselves?
I don't even have to tell her this, because I'm sure that it's in her heart anyways, but don't lose the feeling, because that's what's important. I need to make money, but I would gladly give my vegetables away if I could.
Cool. Yeah, I like that mentality. And for people that haven't started yet and are thinking about it, the best thing that I can tell you is try growing some food and try seeing how it goes. Like, it's not going to be perfect your first time, but the most you can do is just start and try and talk to people. And if you're interested, there's so many people there that could use a hand on their farm if you want to get some experience or want to work. Just ask. Farmers are really nice people, and they'll usually always talk to you.
Farming contributor Dave Kozlowski owns and operates Pine Hole Gardens in Oak Creek with his wife, Sandy Rodenz. Sarah Crone owns and operates Village Farmstead in Oak Creek with her partner, Sam Oden. They first spoke with Audrey Nowakowski in March, and you'll find previous farming conversations at WUWM.com. We'll take a short break and then go from farming to gardening. Expert Melinda Myers joins us next to talk about the health benefits from gardening, what to plant, and how to do it. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Gardening can have a huge impact on your health. Digging holes, pulling weeds, and tilling the soil are great exercises for your body, and they can lead to lower levels of stress. Plus, at the end of it all, you'll have a new source of healthy and delicious food. Lake Effect Gardening contributor Melinda Myers is spending most of her week at the Wisconsin State Fair talking about all of the health benefits of gardening. But first, she stopped by the Lake Effect studio to talk with Joy Powers on the topic.
You know, a lot of gardeners for years know that when they go and pull weeds or plant flowers, myself included, we feel better. It improves our mood. We get rid of some stress. Well, research is now proving that to be true. There's some microbacterium in the soil that they recently discovered that helps fight depression. And they're really researching that to see, they think it could help with bipolar and some other things. When you dig in the soil, they show that it is a stress reliever. And so it improves your mood, reduces stress, increases focus. Kids that are exposed to nature or work in a garden do better in school. They score better on their test. And girls that are raised in a landscape environment tend to suffer less problems with peer pressure. So those are things a lot of us knew instinctively, and now the research backs it. And there's also research that shows communities that have green spaces, whether it's community gardens and parks, the more green space, the lower the overall community health cost. So they're seeing a reduction in illness and disease and reducing those expenditures on health care by having green spaces.
You know, as you mentioned, when you look up gardening for your health, so many of the things that they mention are mental health, you know, stress relieving,
right,
and that kind of thing. But there are also very concrete benefits to the rest of your health.
Oh, exactly. So if you go to the Arthritis Foundation, they talk a lot about gardening as a way to build strength and flexibility to help counteract, you know, it's not going to eliminate arthritis, but it's going to help you live with it and be able to function more normally by exercising. So it does build your body muscles. If weight is an issue, and that's when I've struggled with my whole life, but controlling my weight by gardening is a lot more fun for me. I can get out in the garden easier than going to the gym. Or I've never been a runner, but it gives me a beautiful garden, and I build my strength. I met somebody who said, well, these are my pre-season size clothes, and these are my end-of-the-season clothes. And I went, oh, you have those too, huh? And so it's good for managing weight. And when you rake, you're burning calories. You're dealing with those leaves in the fall to compost them. When you turn the soil, and I always call it a two or three for, you know, you're improving your garden, you're losing weight, and you're growing nutritious vegetables. And if you grow vegetables, and I don't care, it's not just kids, adults too, you're more likely to eat them. I run into a lot of adults that maybe never had a garden or refuse to eat vegetables. And once they pick vegetables from a garden they've grown and then cooked them, they're more likely to eat them. They taste better. You're also improving the environment because less energy is needed. If you grow it in your backyard, then they ship it across the country. You know, all that fuel and that expense as well. And then you control the inputs. You know, a lot of people garden because they want to make sure that they know what chemicals, if any, went on their food. And so for a food safety factor as well. And getting kids excited to eat vegetables, I stopped at my daughter's and she, one of my favorite tomatoes for kids is called Sun Sugar. It's like candy. And one year I grew a bunch, brought them to my grandson's party, and all the mothers thought I was nuts. Oh yeah, tomatoes, they're little yellow cherry tomatoes. Well, my grandkids know how good they are. That bowl was gone. All the kids discovered them because they're nice and sweet. And what a healthy treat. And they looked forward to them. So my daughter started growing them. And last night I stopped by. Mine aren't ripe yet. So I ate about a handful of hers. She had to go out and pick more for the salad. But what a great way to get all of us excited about eating right.
Yeah, and there are other plants. When I was looking up, you know, gardening things that are healthy, of course, vegetables come up, but there are also a number of things that people consider kind of medicinal. A number of them are herbs.
Oh, exactly. So herbs not only flavor our food, but many of them fight some of the diseases, help with inflammation, which is a problem with arthritis and many autoimmune diseases. Again, aromatherapy. I always say gardeners were into aromatherapy before it became, you know, hip and trendy. Lavender for relaxation. Peppermint for alert. You know, if you're ever driving and you're tired and you pop a peppermint in your mouth, you notice you're more alert. Same thing can happen there. So a lot of those herbs work a lot with our moods as well as inflammation and other issues.
I was surprised to see that there were a number of things that people were, now this is not quite gardening, this is more foraging, but things that are just growing naturally that people go, oh, that can help you, that's healthful.
Yes, there's a lot of things we call weeds that many cultures harvest as well as foragers. So you always want to, one, make sure you're allowed to pick before you pick, and two, anytime you're eating something from an area you don't know, make sure it hasn't been treated with some kind of pesticide. But purslane, and we're starting to see a lot of it this year, saw a lot last year, lays flat on the ground, a thick fleshy leaf. It looks succulent. A lot of people will steam that, put a little butter, and say it tastes better than spinach. Lamb's quarters is another one that helps to, you know, improve your body, provide vitamins. And again, it's a weed. It's a weed because it's in our garden. We are growing tomatoes instead. But if you harvest it early, it's very tender and often has a little bit stronger flavor than spinach as well. So there's a lot of greens out there that you can find. And maybe when you're weeding your garden, look at it as harvesting and put them to use. I find if it sounds better than weeding, it's a lot easier to do.
One of the biggest culprits in my garden is one that comes up a lot for health benefits, dandelions.
Yes. And it's been a few very good dandelion years. And the other thing is dandelions help support, I think it's almost 50 pollinators. And we want those pollinators to come to our garden to pollinate our cucumbers, squash, and watermelons. So not only is it healthful, high in vitamin C, I think sailors, when they landed in the Americas, were using the greens, and then colonists were doing the same for help and to prevent scurvy. The flowers are edible. They're a little bitter sometimes, but edible. And I've known people to make dandelion wine as well. So yes, you're right. They're very healthful. One of the things I did in the city, because my neighbors weren't excited about the dandelions in the grass, is after they were done blooming, I had a small yard, so I could easily just snap the heads off so they didn't set seed and spread to my neighbors, and I kept them in my own yard. That's usually enough to keep your neighbors somewhat happy. You know, if you live in the city or even a suburb, you've got to get along with your neighbors. Out in the country, the farmers are pretty tolerant of my big crop of dandelions that look beautiful in bloom. And, you know, they haven't come and put a notice on my door yet. So
kind of on the flip side here, you know, if you're someone who is gardening for your health, who specifically is trying to avoid things like osteoporosis, which I know it can help with, or different arthritic conditions, what are some things that you should avoid? What are some things that you should be saying, maybe that's not for me?
I think one of the big things to do is maybe look for ways to make gardening easier. So I have, before I had my knees replaced 10 years ago, and before I had my knees replaced, I needed a kneeler that had arm supports. And it was pretty depressing because I wasn't that old that I had to have a kneeler. So I took it one day, friends were having a party, and I forgot my lawn chair. So I brought my kneeler out because you could flip it over and it'd be a bench. And so everybody loved it. They didn't need it, but they went out and bought them because it was nice and compact. So I tell everybody that needs a kneeler, it's a good kneeler and it's a party bench. So you just call it a party bench, you feel better. But elevating, using raised beds, containers will get your garden up. It also reduces the size, so fewer weeds to manage. There are a lot of good tools on the market now that are more ergonomic, so you hold your wrist in the right place. Gloves, I always love to touch the soil, but as I've gotten older, I wear gloves and I find I can garden a lot longer because arthritis runs in my family and me, and so it supports my hands so that I can get out and garden longer. Knee pads if you're kneeling, and raised beds. So a lot of it is really looking at doing those things. I know potatoes, tomatoes, the Solanaceae family is not supposed to be good for people with arthritis or diseases with inflammation. I've given up gluten and dairy for the most part, but I can't give up my tomatoes and potatoes. So you're right. There are some food choices that we could make. Growing blueberries, not the best place, but in a pot, there's some nice compact varieties you can grow in a container and create that environment. Cherries are excellent. So there are those anti-inflammatory vegetables and fruit that might counteract when you just can't resist a good BLT.
Well, and the cauliflower and the broccoli, that all those.
Oh, and all that cruciferous family is excellent. Broccoli, when that head, and I just want to mention because we've had such hot weather, if that head starts to form those flowers, you're eating the flower buds, when you see the little yellow petals, it's not as tasty, still edible. harvest that main head, those little sprouts, it'll keep sending up sprouts off the side until a hard, hard frost kills it in fall. So don't just harvest and get rid of it. Cauliflower is a little more challenging. You need to get it in early, or put a transplant in a couple of weeks ago would have been better to harvest in fall. If it matures during hot weather, it really gets kind of funky looking and doesn't taste as good. So it's not, I'm not saying don't grow it, just don't get discouraged. It might take a couple of tries.
Melinda Myers is an expert on all things gardening, and she's a Lake Effect contributor. You can find her all this week at the Wisconsin State Fair in the We Energies Energy Park. Myers will be talking all about healthy gardening every day of the fair at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock. You can find more of her conversations with Lake Effect's Joy Powers at WUWM.com. Coming up after a short break, we'll have a poem by Sean Rand, and essayist Mel Muskimmon talks about trying to get her dad to move into assisted living. Lake Effect returns with both of those in a moment on 89.7 WUWM. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Those of us who are baby boomers often find ourselves trying to convince our elderly parents to move out of their too big, too dangerous homes and into safer quarters. And most of us are met with resistance. Well, essayist Mel Muskimmon wasn't, at least not in the way you'd expect.
My 89-year-old father had come to his own conclusion to put the house up for sale that had been home for 63 years, the one he and my mother bought after they got married. And she said she'd never leave unless it was feet first. And, well, that happened. He made the decision after he'd gone out to the garage for a screwdriver, lost his balance, and got himself wedged between the snowblower and the car, and had to crawl back to the house because of the ice on the driveway, pretending he was a soldier on the beach at Normandy. My sister and I found him a nice one-bedroom apartment in an upscale senior community where women outnumber the men 4-1. He had caused several fluffy blue-haired heads to turn when we took the tour. Quite the catch. Full head of hair, still able to drive. He was all in until he read the fine print under the photo of the vibrant elderly couple. No weapons allowed. I counted 2 shotguns and 3 rifles inside the fancy-carved gun cabinet. Single barrel, wood stocks. One had pump action. "I've got a World War II carbine somewhere," he said from deep inside what had been my mother's closet. He came back with 4 more rifles, 3 more shotguns. He brought out the .38 Special, a 6-shooter, the one he wore holstered and strapped to his side for 40 years. More rifles came from under the bed, more shotguns from behind the bookcase. He spread his arsenal on top of the duck hunting themed quilt my mother had made, like a cache from a drug bust. "What do they mean, no weapons allowed?"
"No guns, Dad," I said.
"Well, not even the handguns? I've only got 5.
He hooked his thumbs inside his red suspenders and shook his head. I said a silent prayer to my departed mother to please not let this be a deal breaker. I couldn't take another winter worrying about him. What if there'd be a repeat of the screwdriver incident, and instead of the D-Day, he'd end up like Ernest Shackleton, frost-covered with a tool in his frozen hand, wedged between the car and the snowblower?
"I got that one when I was 12. He pointed to a rifle with a barreled stock. "This one?" He gently lifted a double-barrel shotgun off an airborne pair of mallards. "I almost sold it to pay the hospital bill after you were born." And now he had to say goodbye to old friends that had served him well, supplied us with venison salamis, pheasant breasts, so many ducks. Word had spread. Pals came sniffing around, gathering in small packs at the end of the driveway, like dogs had done that time our old Labrador Shadow had gone into heat. Lucrative offers had been made. The kind of person would have been crazy not to take. But we couldn't. I mean, he had already sold his boat, his truck, had slowly given away his fishing equipment. This felt like we were asking too much, like he wouldn't be him anymore. I just couldn't. I mean, his face, almost as drawn as the day my mother had gotten so sick. No. We agreed the guns would stay in the family, in a safe, the combination known only to Dad. He could visit them, take them out, make sure they were being looked after properly. And we agreed to do the same, visit him in his new apartment, take him out, make sure he was looked after properly. I mean, it's the least we could do.
Lake Effect essayist Mel Muskimmon is the author of Cop's Kid and Sit, Stay, Heal. She lives in Milwaukee. You can find all of her essays for us at WUWM.com. Sean Ramft has been our sports contributor for quite some time, but he's also a poet and shares one with us now.
This poem is called Underwater Unsettlement. Don't shut your eyes when there's so much overhead. Cycle after cycle, it all remains the same, yet different, from one landing to the next. Rain starts to fall, tickling, trickling down each friendly face. Drops continue, and it is in that moment you remember. Like clouds overhead, words can break. As the moon rises, a remedy refuses to reverse the vision of a smile slinking under the sea. However friendly, you cannot get past the holes throughout its body. However wholesome, you shudder to think what rests above the surface. Then a thought occurs, a most terrible thought. What will the bear of the bay say if you fail to return? Though, on the other hand, you're already underneath the water. So, you might as well enjoy it, no matter how unsettling the smile. Cycle after cycle, it comes from a place of sincerity. Plus, there's nothing left to heal, regardless of whether you have the means at your side. With each step, things get a little smoother. Now, you're skipping stones underwater, but you cannot speak, you cannot breathe. All you see is that unsettling smile. All you sense is that nervous energy as the bay bear submerges itself to take what was rightfully his. Before you slithered under the sea, things were simpler. Now there's nowhere to swim but up, and you're out of your depth.
Poet Sean Ramft is also our sports contributor. Today he read his poem, Underwater Unsettlement. We'll take one last break and then talk with the actor and playwright behind this weekend's show, Raghead, An American Story. That conversation continues in a moment on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Bonnie North. On a fateful Sunday morning 7 years ago, Sundeep Morrison received a phone call from her brother in Wisconsin that shook her to her core. A white supremacist had attacked the Oak Creek Sikh temple where her parents usually went to pray. Morrison's parents happened to have been elsewhere that morning, but 6 people lost their lives at the hands of the shooter. As she dealt with her anger, fear, and sadness, the Los Angeles-based writer, actor, director, and activist began to write as a form of therapy. Those early writings evolved into a one-woman show called Raghead, An American Story. It's making its Milwaukee debut this weekend at the Broadway Theater Center. Morrison spoke with Lake Effect's Allison Dukanovich via Skype about the play and what she hopes it will accomplish.
The impetus for me to write it was, I would say, a lot of pain and anger. So my family is very heavily involved in Wisconsin. Both of my parents live in Wisconsin. I spent my summers growing up there. And the day of the shooting, I was in Los Angeles with my daughter, and my brother also lives in Wisconsin with my parents. And like any other American, you know, they go every Sunday to their place of worship and they bow their heads in prayer. And I received a frantic call, and it was my younger brother asking if I had heard from my parents. And for me, it was normal for their phones to be off because they'd be sitting in meditation. And so I reassured him. I said, you know what? They're probably sitting in prayer. And he said, no, turn on the news. Something horrible has happened. So I much like most of America, watch the events unfold on the news. And I felt completely helpless. So for about an hour, we couldn't get in touch with my parents, and I thought the worst. The only thing that the sheriff's department would confirm was that there were fatalities. And so we resorted to watching CNN coverage to see if we could see their cars in the parking lot. And that moment is something that I could not shake, just the panic of not knowing. After an hour, my mom called and she said, you know what, we're okay, but you know, we've lost a lot of people. And that devastation is something that was very heavy, of just knowing that, you know, there's only three places of worship for six in all of Wisconsin. And knowing how easily my parents could have been victims is something that really hit me hard. So I began to write. I wrote as a source of release, as a source of therapy, just to get my emotions out. And my father lost one of his first cousins and several family friends, and I was angry and sad. So I wrote it as a short story, and one of the main characters is based on my father, and there's a character based on my mother and my cousin. And after I shared it with my mom, who is my biggest fan, she said, you know what, you should put this out there. And then I really thought about it, and that's how Raghead came to be.
So you mentioned that you kind of started writing from this place of anger and kind of as a cathartic form of processing a lot of that emotion. What were some maybe challenges that came with producing a piece that was so personal, and how do you think that maybe, one, was challenging, but two, maybe enhanced the play and how you perform it?
Well, first, I was apprehensive because anytime you touch on the subject of religion or politics, people are going to criticize. And because I'm not a turban-wearing sick, I immediately thought, you know, am I sick enough to put this narrative out there? Mm. It made me analyze my own faith. And also as an actor, I first was looking to cast this as an ensemble piece when I started to really flesh it out and write it as a play. And I couldn't find sick actors. And when I shared it with a close friend and colleague, she said, you know, you should play all the characters. And I thought, well, that's a little narcissistic. But in really wanting to put the story out there, because each character is based on someone I know. And so I really just committed and I said, you know what, I want to share this story. So there were some challenges in terms of putting the narrative out there, but I received a lot of support because for me, this is my vehicle for activism, is my writing. And Sikhi is not a proselytizing faith. We don't seek to convert. We say, practice what you want to practice. We want to live in harmony and foster peace. So those were some of the challenges that I faced in terms of my own internal dialogue of how I related to my faith.
Kind of raised all of these questions of your own identity as you are grappling
yeah.
with the identity of your community and of your family. So it seems like the play really aims to dispel some of maybe the myths or stereotypes about Sikh culture in America. And what do you hope that people learn about Sikh culture that maybe they didn't know before?
Well, you know, the turban is an article of faith, especially in Sikhi. And the turban is actually an identifying marker to let people know that if you're in trouble, we will help you. And our faith is a little over 500 years old. A lot of people don't know who we are or what our faith entails. And there's over 500,000 Sikhs living in the United States. And we are immersed in the fabric of American history. But over 70% of Americans don't know who we are. So for me, if someone can walk away having experienced and been part of the story and have a deeper sense of understanding, then I've done my job in terms of advocacy and as an artist.
Do you feel like in the past that you said that 70% of people don't know who Sikhs are? Do you think that the media or other cultural institutions have kind of failed in how we represent Sikh Americans in our culture today?
I do. I think that we were thrust into the spotlight after 9/11, and it was very new for us. There was this new territory of being in the media and how to handle that. All of a sudden, our faith, our identity, the way we look, our aesthetic was put under a microscope, if you will. And I feel that the media has a responsibility to really report and also just to spread that awareness. But I do feel that after 9/11, there were a lot of misconceptions about our faith. And so it was quite a trying time for us, I feel.
Yeah, and you kind of talked about that living in post 9/11 America as a Sikh American. You said there's been an increase in hate crimes against Sikhs and Muslims and other immigrant communities. Do you think that xenophobia and crimes related to that has improved in our communities or not necessarily?
I mean, I think full transparency in this current socio-political climate, I think that anytime there's political rhetoric, it's going to be echoed in how citizens treat each other. And I think we're in a very divisive time right now. And I think it's actually gotten worse. I think everything that was maybe said or felt behind doors is now right at our doorstep. And it's a very scary time. And even that fateful day, the Sikh and the Muslim community came together because there is a masjid not too far from the Oak Creek Temple, the Oak Creek Gurdwara. And so our Muslim brothers and sisters thought, oh gosh, this shooter was probably looking to target us and ended up at your doorstep. So for us, it was really important that we didn't other, because, you know, anyone that commits a crime in the name of Islam, they are not the representatives of the faith. Just as if someone commits a crime in the name of Christianity, we don't make them emblematic of that faith. But there is, I feel like we're plagued by a sense of othering in America. And that's what I hope to show in the play is how do we really, you know, view Americans, who is really an American?
Yeah, that was something that I was going to get at. It seems like throughout Reichhead that your characters really are exploring that concept of what it means to look American or to be American. And what does that concept of American identity maybe mean to you? And how does your work really wrestle with that idea?
I mean, even now with what Rep. Ilhan Omar and what's going on in terms of just the verbiage of go back or send her back.
There's a line that kind of gave me chills when reading through the script. There's a line that someone actually says that, go back to your country. And that's been such a topic in public dialogue recently because of comments from the president.
Yeah, and I think that's a commonplace sentiment of the bigotry. America is beautiful, and it has a rich, diverse history of immigrants contributing, building the infrastructure. You know, as a child of immigrants, working class immigrants, my parents have taken pride. They love this country. And I think that those sentiments, I've heard them time and time again, uttered to my parents, to myself. And I think that's where, for me as an American, I feel like, after 9/11, we almost had to become hyper-patriotic, if you will. They were handing out bumper stickers in the Gurdwara. We put them on our windows, and we were wearing flag pins, almost to have to prove that we were American, that we weren't here to hurt anybody. But I think that's the question of identity, is how can we stand united if our thinking is divided?
Yeah. And so how do you kind of hope that your play and your work can further or can add to that conversation about that idea of identity and our divided thinking that you just mentioned?
I hope that I show all shades of racism, the upfront in-your-face racism, the softer racism. And I think that you can be non-racist, but what we really need is anti-racist. We need to shift advocate and ally from a noun to a verb. So I really implore, and especially because my goal is to take this into white spaces, especially the white audience, to say, look, we need you as allies. And this is how you can become an ally, is by, you know, when you're having that moment sitting amongst friends and they utter a pejorative, you have a choice. You have a choice to disrupt and change the dialogue and take a stand, or you can be silent and be complicit. So for me, it's really, I hope people walk away with a sense of action and to really do better, and also a deeper understanding of their Sikh American brothers and sisters.
Yeah, what does that mean to you, that word ally? I feel like that's a word that's tossed around so often, but you mentioned that it's a verb, and what does that look like?
I think that an ally for me is someone who will sit in that discomfort and will disrupt the narrative, even if that means that they lose something. That's true allyship.
Obviously, you're commemorating the 7th anniversary of the shooting that happened in the Sikh community here, but why did you want to bring your play to this city, and kind of what kind of partnerships did you establish to get it here, and what do you hope the conversation adds to this city in particular?
Well, this is all because of Pardeep Kaleka, who has done a lot of work and a lot of advocacy in Milwaukee. And he lost his father, who was the president and founder of our Gurdwara. And I shared my play with him, and also Deanna Singh, who is a very well-respected thought leader. She's an entrepreneur and an advocate. And in sharing my work, it's a huge honor and a full circle moment. It really meant a lot for me because this is such an intimate piece to get Pardeep's feedback and to see how he felt about it, how it resonated with him.
Yeah. Was that surprising at all? Did you guys know each other before?
Yeah, we actually grew up in the same community.
Okay.
And you know, his dad and my father were really close. And we don't say Mr. or Mrs. in our community. Everyone is uncle and auntie.
Okay.
So he's always been a really inspirational figure, like a big brother. And it's the same with Deanna. Deanna has done extraordinary work, and she is so inspiring. So for me, taking the show to the community, it's such a big deal because I wanted to make sure that I did it right. And these people were immensely affected. We all were. But to bring a narrative based on the community to the community, I wanted to handle it with utmost respect and care.
So you're an artist, you're an activist. It seems like you wear all of these different hats. Why did you choose theater as a way to spark this conversation? And
I think for me, theater is so intimate. It's you're in a space, you're holding space with individuals, and it's moment to moment. And for me, I've always felt that in those spaces, I can feel very connected to the audience in telling a story. So ultimately, I've always viewed myself as a storyteller. And so the theater space, that intimacy, I feel, especially given the subject matter, I feel I can have a deeper connection.
Yeah. And what do you hope that connection will foster? What do you really hope that people leave the theater with after they see Raghead?
I hope they leave the theater with a deeper sense of understanding, empathy, and also hopefully inspire them to be that change, to really, you know, enact upon that allyship and deepen their advocacy as Americans.
Sundeep Morrison will perform her one-woman show, Raghead, An American Story, at the Broadway Theater Center this weekend. There's a link to more information about the play and all the related events around it at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.